I'm Mike Asnald, and welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series podcast. This is a series where we talk to artists who are doing amazing things in the areas of the arts, including performance, education, production, as well as arts advocacy. We record this series in the Virginia and John Nolan Black Box Studio, as well as in the Jan and Bill Grimes Recording Studio here at the Cary Siraj Community Arts Center. Be sure to visit artsbr.org for more information on all the great things we are doing here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Hope you enjoy the podcast series, and thanks for tuning in.
I'd like to welcome our AC 23 plus listeners and viewers to another session. I'm Mike Esnault, Director of Arts and Education here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. And today I have a really special guest, an amazing drummer, who I've admired for many years now, Mr. Leon Anderson. Leon.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being my guest.
I am very delighted to be here.
Well, so before we get into, you know, talking, I want to do a proper introduction. So Leon is an internationally known drummer, composer, music educator, clinician. As far as performing, you know, this might take a while, hang on. you perform with the Czech National Symphony Orchestra with Ellis Marsalis Trio, National Orchestra de France with Marcus Roberts Trio, who you've worked with for quite a bit over the years, right? Umbria Jazz Festival. I've actually played that festival. That's a great festival.
It's a great festival.
Man. Yep. Ingolstadt Jazz Stage in Ingolstadt, Bavaria. Mm-hmm. North Sea Jazz Festival. And I could probably go on. You could go on for a long time.
Sure.
All the places you played around the world.
We're fortunate, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Recordings. You've recorded with Victor Goings. Mm-hmm. Several albums?
Three
albums. Mm-hmm. Marcus Roberts, Cole After Midnight, Volume 1.
Yes.
Etienne Charles, Culture Shock.
Mm-hmm. That was his first record. Yep.
And a Five by Design. Now, was that with our friend
Willis Deloney.
Dr. Willis Deloney?
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
A wonderful pianist. And the list goes on. But also, you have your own album.
Yes.
That just came out recently, which you recorded at Snook Harbor in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that album.
Yes, so I was here.
Let's start with that.
Man, that's great. So I was here as a guest with the UNO Jazz Studies Department for the Jazz at the Sandbar series.
Yeah.
So the way that works is Jason Patterson has you as a guest at UNO, and then once you go play with the students, you do a workshop, and you perform with the students, then there's also you do a concert at Snug Harbor as a part of the package deal. So when I was there playing at Snug, Jason, right before the gig started, he said, Leon, we don't have any music to play before your set starts. And I was like, I've never done a record under my name before. And he said, well, you need to solve that issue by recording here. Hmm. That's how the record happened.
Okay.
Few months after that, I, you know, went back to school, obviously, and I just applied for a grant and to help me fund the recording. Mm-hmm. And so put it all together. And booked a weekend at Snug Harbor with Jason, and we recorded two sets of music. So
was that over one night, or you did two nights there?
I did one night, but two shows.
Two shows, yeah.
And we just took the best takes from two shows. I wanted it to be what the music is in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we obviously rehearsed a couple of times before, but we just hit, you know.
And who were the musicians on that set?
So on that recording, we have on tenor saxophone, Ricardo Pascal, John Michael Bradford on trumpet, Oscar Rossignoli on piano.
One of my favorites. Yep.
My colleague at FSU, Rodney Jordan on bass,
and
myself on drums.
Outstanding. And you guys are, you're playing tonight here at the Arts Council.
Yes.
With a similar band, some of the same personnel, but different trumpet. You have
Stephen Lanz,
another amazing musician. And then
on bass, I have Amina Scott.
Wow.
Which is one of our former students, actually.
Did she go to...
Amina came to FSU to do her master's degree
in jazz studies. I don't know if I knew that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing I failed to mention in the introduction is that you are a faculty member. You've been a faculty member for quite a few years at Florida State University.
This is my 28th year.
28th?
Yes.
Wow. How do you do that when you only look 25?
Oh, man, come on. Man, they say that the music keeps you... You know, young or whatever.
Yeah.
So, but I'm fortunate, man. I think just the music, the students. You know, I love what I do. So,
that's very important. I'm a soul believer in that.
Yeah, man, definitely.
Well, let me kind of back up. So, are you originally from Shreveport?
Yes.
So, man, some good drummers coming out of Shreveport.
Mm-hmm.
So are you, I'm thinking of Brian Blade.
Sure.
So are y'all about the same age?
I'm 1 year older than Brian.
Okay. So did y'all know each other, coming up in Shreveport?
We knew each other growing up, but we didn't like necessarily travel in the same circles.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Brian went to a performing arts high school, like a magnet school. I went to just a regular public school.
Yeah.
I knew of him we might cross paths here and there, but we never really like hung out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so just coming up though in that environment in Shreveport, like how did you get into music? How did it start?
My family, my father and my mother are both music educators. So my father was a high school band director. My mother was a choral music teacher.
Oh, so you couldn't help it.
I was just born into it. Yeah. And I was the kid that went with my father to high school band rehearsals, mm-hmm. whether it was outside in the sun, I would sit under the ladder. or when the band was rehearsing inside the band room, I would go and sneak in the drum room and just kind of play on the instruments or whatever, man. So I grew up in it, literally.
So was it, but drums in particular, that you were drawn to that first and foremost?
Yes, or
that,
okay. definitely. But yeah. I mean, I studied trombone a little bit. I don't say that too loud.
It's okay.
Yeah, I this was around middle school age.
Right.
I played a little bit of trombone, but I've always played percussion ever since I was probably about third, fourth grade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess coming from that pedigree, you know, you're taught. I'm sure you're listening to all kinds of music in your house, but you're also really taught that, you know, to read and the fundamentals.
Sure.
Coming from parents like that.
Yeah. I guess I was about 8 or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. There was a community marching drum line, mm-hmm. called the Peppermints. And so we were working on drum cadences and things like that. So I was already getting tutelage, if you will, on just, you know, how to properly hold the sticks, how to play drums, how to listen, things mm-hmm. like that. So some things came to me kind of natural. And then by the time I got to middle school or junior high school at the time, reading music made sense to me. Like, I was like, I'm already playing this, but this is what it looks like.
Right.
So I dove in and really got into like reading like snare drum etudes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also played a little bit of piano. I didn't study piano, mm-hmm. but I was always at my mother's piano.
Okay.
You know, hearing things, kind of transcribing things that I would hear on the radio, stuff like that.
Right.
So I was able to pick out melodies and figure out chords and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So.
Now, were you one of those kids that, you know, played in church?
Yeah, played some in church. Mm-hmm. Played in like rock and funk bands in high school, stuff right. like that. But I was the typical kid that came up in a public school where we did marching band, concert band. I played timpani, mallets.
Mm-hmm.
I did all of that stuff. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So much of your career has been, you know, of course, involved in the jazz idiom. When did that start? Like, were your parents jazz fans, or how did you kind of get hip to that music?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. My father, obviously, as a high school band director, he had, at the time they called it, back in the day, they called it a stage band.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But, so he had a jazz ensemble at the school.
Okay.
So, I mean, I heard the marching band. Of course, I heard his concerts with the concert symphonic band, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he always had a set that the jazz band would play. But he also had like a big record collection at mm-hmm. home. And when he was in his leisure time, I would hear Miles Davis or I would hear John Coltrane. But mm-hmm. I would also hear Gladys Knight. I would hear Stevie Wonder. So
yeah.
And you know, we come from playing in church, so I heard gospel music.
Right.
My father loved Tchaikovsky, so I listened to a lot of Tchaikovsky,
mm-hmm.
Beethoven. I mean, I just heard all kinds of music at the house.
Right.
So
what
I think
a, what
I just
a blessing
grew into
that
it.
Is, man. I mean, to grow up in that.
Yes, indeed. But I got into jazz, though, my later years of high school. Now, first of all, I did not attend my father's high school. A lot of people confuse that.
Oh, I just assumed you did.
Yeah.
Okay.
My father taught at another school that was not zoned for where we live.
I see. Okay.
So I went to the high school where I was zoned to go. But for me, getting into jazz, my high school band director, Mr. Malcolm Spencer, we started playing like some Ellington charts. And we also played, I think at the time, Herbie Hancock's Chameleon was very popular, mm-hmm. some Chick Corea stuff.
Yeah.
They were printing all that stuff in big band arrangements at the time.
Sure.
So we were playing all that music.
Yeah.
And it was at that point that I was like, I want to learn more about this. And so I started going and pulling my father's records and taking them back to my room.
Mm.
And I remember grabbing Kind of Blue and taking it back to my room and putting it on and putting headphones on and trying to understand the sound. And then, no one told me this, I kind of figured it out myself. I was like, well, if I want to sound like this, I ought to play with the drummer on the record. So I started if you want to say transcribing, mm-hmm. without being told to transcribe.
Right.
I was just like, I'm trying to find what the sound is.
Right.
And so I was trying to match the ride cymbal sound. I was trying to match what he was doing with the left hand.
Right. And how old were you at this point?
Probably about 16.
Okay.
Yeah. That it. I mean, you know, I had already been doing marching band and concert band, stuff mm-hmm. like that, but
right.
I hadn't really studied jazz necessarily, and then the coordination involved.
Right.
You know, playing rock and funk music, you know, you just kind of open, close the hi-hat, play a backbeat,
yeah.
and, you know, some kind of bass drum rhythm against it. But in jazz, I was like, oh, he's playing the hi-hat on, like the pocket is 2 and 4, but he's doing something else with the left hand,
mm-hmm.
and he's doing something here with the right hand, and he's playing accents on the bass drum. So that was like four-way coordination. So I had mm-hmm. to figure that out.
Yeah.
So first I was hearing it, and then I got hip to, like, finding a few books
mm-hmm.
that had this stuff written out. And I was like, oh, okay, this is what's happening. So I started reading the patterns in the book, and I was like, oh, okay, the records tell me what it sounds like, but this is what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, so that just tells me at an early age, you had a strong curiosity.
Yes.
About it, a drive.
Yes.
To mm-hmm. do it. Was there, you know, was there a jazz drum instructor there that you were studying with, or was it more or less learning by the records?
Yes, a combination of some things.
Okay.
I took lessons from a guy by the name of Doug Parmalee, who was the principal percussionist with the Shreveport Symphony.
Okay.
So I studied snare drum,
mm-hmm.
some mallets with him, and some timpani.
Yeah.
As far as playing drum kit or learning jazz, it was purely records for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd never, to this day, I'm ashamed to say this in a way, but to this day, I've never had a drum set teacher.
Right.
I've always taught myself or learned from records or transcribed. I learned percussion technique in college, studying the snare drum,
mm-hmm.
working on rudiments, finding different books here and there to like work on coordination ideas from and stuff like that. But most of my playing has come from like records.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, so, okay, so you finish up high school. Where did you go to college?
Went to Louisiana Tech University.
Okay.
Up in Ruston. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know it's a big tech school, but they had a pretty, I mean, it's a small music department, but it was a very vibrant music department.
And you were a music major?
I was a music major, music education.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, but you made your way down to South Louisiana, so tell me about how that came about.
Okay. So when I graduated from Louisiana Tech, I mean, obviously while I was there, I played in the jazz band all 4.5 years that I was there.
Yeah.
We formed a little small jazz combo
mm-hmm.
within the school. I mean, there was not a jazz major there.
Right.
Like, I was a music ed major. We didn't really even have any jazz courses. We just had a big band.
Mm-hmm.
So we formed our own small group that played outside of the school. We played around town.
Yeah.
That's where my interest really peaked. Like, I really want to learn more about this.
Mm-hmm.
But when I finished school, I went right to grad school. I went to Baylor University as a classical percussionist.
Oh, okay.
So I went to Baylor for 1 year,
mm-hmm.
And I was doing percussion performance. And it was at that time, while I was at Baylor, I decided that I did not really want to go back to school and pursue classical percussion
mm-hmm.
necessarily. And I just felt like I needed a break. But it was also, just wondering how these things line up, around this time that my father passed away.
Okay.
So I felt like I needed to come back home to Louisiana. But I still wanted to go to grad school. And New Orleans became of interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
So the school that was, recruiting me or what have you, was Southeastern Louisiana University.
Yeah,
and Hammond. And my father knew at the time the dean of that school of music.
Yeah,
can't remember his name right now. But so just right before my father passed, he kind of made that connection for me.
Yeah.
So I auditioned and got in the program, and so I started school that fall after my father passed at Southeastern.
Okay,
and that's ironically where I met Willis Deloney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he'd been there, he taught there for quite a while.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he was probably my first real jazz mentor.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I played in a big band while I was there. I was still there as a percussion major, a classical percussion major.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I took some jazz courses with Willis, and I got a chance to play with him
right.
as well. And by that time, I think Southeastern had a jazz camp,
mm-hmm.
that I would go teach, and that's where I met several folks. I think Willis taught that. I think Willis taught that camp. There was a trumpet player named Craig Konacek, I think.
Okay.
And there's a bass player there. Ed, he lives in New Orleans now.
Ed Wise, maybe?
Ed Wise, I'm sorry. Yeah. I couldn't think of his last name. Ed Wise teaches at, I think he's at Loyola.
He is. Yeah. That's correct.
Ed Wise had me at that camp. So it was with Ed that I started playing a gig at this place called Pampy's
on the coast. Oh, I remember Pampy's.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
On the coast in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And this is while I was a student at Southeastern. Mm-hmm. And there I met, that's where I met first, first met Don Vappy there. Yeah. I met Sharon Martin there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that was my introduction into getting into the scene in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Sharon Martin needed a drummer. I started playing with her and Walter Payton.
Oh, wow.
At this place called The Showcase.
Yeah, I remember The Showcase, yeah.
Like twice a week. Don hired me for some gigs.
Yeah.
And it was one particular gig that I was on with Sharon and Walter where I met Victor Goins for the first time.
Mm.
And so that's where I got connected with Victor. And then shortly after that, Mr. Marcellus had a student who was doing a recital at UNO and needed a drummer. And so I played for that student's recital. Mr. Marcellus was there.
Yep.
So that's where I met Mr. Marcellus. And maybe a week later, he invited me down to Snug Harbor. And Jason was playing.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, you should come by the gig and come sit in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how all of my connections happened in New Orleans. So I was still in school. But I started working in the city a few times a week while I was in school.
Right.
So that really was my, if you want to say my jazz education, that was it. It was the combination of Willis and the city.
Well, and it speaks to just the power of connections.
Yeah, sure.
Freelancing.
Exactly.
One thing leads to another. And,
right, exactly.
And I think we both probably have similar stories in that Most of the opportunities that have come along, it's not so much us, you know, going out and auditioning. That does happen sometimes, but like it's so much of word of mouth, you know, in associations.
Yep.
I taught for many years, and I would always tell my students, it's really a combination of associations and reputation.
Yeah, right.
And of course, skill.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
Well, so you finish up at Southeastern,
and
then what happens?
Yeah, so I graduated that, whatever that spring was, 96, I think. And it was weird. I think we finished in like April or May.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe by June, July, Mr. Marcellus called and said, hey, man, would you be interested in doing some teaching at UNO? He's like, you know, you've got a master's degree, and we need a drum set teacher. And he said, I also want to have someone who has some percussion knowledge to come in, because at the time, he was like, a lot of my drummers don't have any thing outside of just playing the drum set that they can be exposed to. And he was like, with your background as a percussionist, we'd love for you to come in and kind of help them with like having more of a melodic concept in their playing. So I came onto the faculty as an adjunct faculty. And also, at the time, Jason was leaving his band. Jason was, I think, just graduating high school, and he went to school at Loyola to study percussion. So he said, man, I need a drummer. So at the same time, I went to work at UNO, and I also joined Mr. Marcellus's band.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was at UNO, I started a percussion ensemble.
Okay.
I taught a combo, and I had about three or four students or so.
Yeah.
So that's how, and I moved on into the city, and that kind of really started that phase of my career was, starting to teach at UNO and just starting to work around the city. You know?
And did you find that when you started teaching in that capacity, I guess the college level, that it really resonated, like you enjoyed it?
Yes. I knew that that's something that I wanted to do down the line, but I really was trying to play as much as I could.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just wanted to experience. Yeah, I started... I was beginning to travel around that time as well, so I wanted to, have a chance to see a little bit of the world through playing, but also, come back home and be able to go teach some lessons or what have you. So,
well, and of course, New Orleans has such a deep, long history of drummers.
I know.
Yes. So I'm sure that had a huge impact, right?
Yes.
Being around a Herlin Riley, a Shannon Powell. Do you just go down the list?
Yes.
You know.
Herlin Riley, Bunchy Johnson.
Yeah.
You know, Gerald French.
Yeah.
Shannon Powell. Mm-hmm. I mean, all those guys were very influential.
Right.
Leon Alexander.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, bunch of guys. It's a legacy there.
Sure.
Great drummers. I mean, the history of our drumming starts there.
Right. Right.
Baby Dodge, Dee Dee Chandler, uh-huh. Zooty Singleton, all those, you know.
Yeah.
So the history in that city attracted me as well. Just mm-hmm. learning the history of my instrument.
Right.
As much as learning my instrument, you know.
What about the food?
Always the food. Always the food. No, man, yeah, the music and the food. You know, whenever we would travel, that's what people would say. Oh, New Orleans, great food or music all the time.
And they go hand in hand.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was great. New Orleans for me was, it really was, if you want to say my springboard or my foundation,
mm-hmm.
you know, I learned a lot.
Yeah.
I think I grew up in the music there.
Yeah, it's there really is, and I guess you know, or you certainly know, as you travel around the world more and more, mm-hmm. There really is no place like that.
Yeah.
Culturally and just the whole vibe.
Yeah, I miss it every day.
Yeah.
I really do. I do miss the city. I love where I am, but I do miss the city.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so then how do you make your way over to Florida State?
I was at UNO teaching. Mm-hmm. This is the weirdest story. A phone call came to the jazz office, and Kirby was at the time the office manager. She said, "Leon, that's a phone call for you." And she said, "It's somebody named Bill Peterson."
Huh.
And yeah. I didn't know who he was, so I picked up the phone, and he said, "Hi, I'm Bill Peterson. I teach at Florida State University, and your name was given to me through a couple of different sources. One of the sources was Bill Grimes."
Mm-hmm.
Because Bill Peterson had a connection with Bill Grimes.
Sure.
From Eastman.
Probably Eastman.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and then there was another person that he talked to named Bob Breithaupt, great drummer, based out of, I think he's in Columbus, Ohio. And so both of them brought my name up. And so he said, "Well, maybe I should call this Leon Anderson." So I talked to Bill for a little while, and we had a conversation. He's like, "Well, we're looking for a drummer to come in as a full-time tenure track, you know, person." And so I told him, "Well, let me think about it. I'll get back to you, what have you." I had a conversation with Mr. Marcellus about it. And I had no intentions of leaving New Orleans at the time. As a matter of fact, I think my trajectory was, if I left New Orleans, it would be for New York.
Right.
At the time. He almost gave me one of those sit down, let me talk to you father son kind of talks. And he said, "Leon," he said, "New Orleans will always be here." He said, and I realized you might be looking in some other directions. He was like, "But this might be what is like your calling or something to that degree." He's like, "You should at least investigate the situation." He was like, "If you look down the road," he's like, "in about 20 years," and he was right. He said, "In about 20 years, people are going to be seeking out these positions."
Wise words.
Wise words. And he said, "I would at least go investigate it and, you know, go on the interview and see what it's about, see if it's something that would be of interest to you."
Mm.
So I took his advice. I went and did the interview, and I thought it went well. I think there were maybe a couple of other people they looked at. So I didn't necessarily expect the call back, you know. But sure enough, about two weeks after the interview, they gave me a call.
Mm-hmm.
And offered me the position.
Yeah.
And then I had another conversation with Mr. Marcellus, like, "Should I take it?" And he was like, "Yes." Hmm. He's like, "These positions are going to be hard to get, you know, 20 years down the road."
Yeah.
A full-time tenured.
Sure.
Yeah. And then one of the other stipulations of the job was that we will not curtail you from your touring or recording duties. We want you to do that.
That's
because it makes
cap.
The university look yeah. good. And he was like, "If they're going to give you that kind of flexibility, I would take that job."
Yeah.
I've been there 28 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot to do with Ellis Marcellus.
Yeah. He definitely helped me make my decision.
Yeah.
You know, and I still played with them off and on. Even I would drive back to New Orleans every now and then, so mm-hmm. played a couple of jazz fests with him.
Right.
But after a while, I started getting busy. Mm-hmm. And he realized that. And, you know, so he just, you know, Jason would come back and play sometimes. And then he just started working with other younger drummers in the city, which is what he should do. You know, that's, yeah, I mean, that's, he was a mentor to me in that way. So, yeah.
28 years. So in that time, talk to a little bit to like how you've seen the educational thing change, if it has changed from your perspective in those 28 years, teaching jazz education on the college level.
Yeah, well, one of the first things I had to do, so I was there about 2-3 years before I assumed the directorship of the jazz program. When I first came, I was just hired as the drum set teacher, and I did like the second big band. I started the combo program there, which is doing very well, by the way.
So prior to that, there was no real small group stuff going on?
No small group stuff. It was just, we had two big bands, and students would just kind of put their own groups together and play around town. Okay. But coming from UNO, that was their program.
Right.
It's like all the
combos. It was always about small groups.
Yeah. So I helped to kind of build that program there. And so I guess the deans saw that I had like a vision in that way. And so we had like a shift change, if you will. And I kind of took on the role, like I started doing the top band and kind of being the representative for the program. And I also helped hire a lot of our additional faculty that are there now. So that was the first thing I noticed, is that students want to go and study with people who play their instruments. Yeah. When I got there, I was the drummer, we had a pianist and a saxophone teacher. And I was like, well, man, it's going to be hard to recruit trumpet players and trombone players when you can go to other schools, North Texas or some of these other, Miami, and these students are getting the opportunity to study with people that play their instrument.
That in itself is the recruiting aspect of it.
So the first thing I had to do was hire the faculty so that we can expand the program. So that was the first thing I noticed about like where jazz education was kind of moving. It's like people are now, it's not just the one wind player on the faculty teaching everybody. You know, you need to have a sax teacher, you need to have a trumpet teacher, a trombone teacher, et cetera. You know, so that was the first thing. And then the second thing was getting the students exposed to like learning tunes. So helping to build the small group program, establishing some other classes or courses that work inside of the curriculum. When I first got there, we only had a Bachelor of Arts degree in jazz studies, which is basically a 2-year degree. And we kind of doctored it up to work for 4 years. But after a while, the accreditation, college accreditation, NASM, I think, you know, said that we need to have like an actual music degree for jazz studies. So we built our Bachelor of Music degree. So that was another thing that I noticed.
And you were a big part of that.
We, myself, Rodney Jordan, great bass player, is on my record too. yes, that's my man. We figured out that we needed to have a real music degree in the bachelor's for in the undergraduate program, I should say. And so that's one of the other things that we did is we built a Bachelor of Music degree. We still have the BA degree as like a secondary degree, but we established the BM degree. When I first got there, we also we did have an MM degree, so we had a Master's of Music degree, but we kind of beefed that degree up. We wrote the degree for the undergraduate program, so that was the other thing, is to kind of actually have a real music degree to attract more students. And then as things changed, and another thing that I noticed too was like the record industry changed. The internet had a lot to do with it. You know, I moved there right when Napster and all that.
Kind of the streaming
thing started. Streaming was just getting started. And everything was changing. Record stores were closing. So we had to refigure some things. And figure out, like, students coming into school now, you know, how are they going to learn, hear music and things like that? So everybody was streaming everything. Like, one of the things that we noticed is that a lot of students now don't know the records that they're listening. Like, they don't know who's on the record.
They're not holding or the CD or the album and looking at all that information.
So that's one thing that I learned, too, through teaching my students in my studio. I make them research.
Yeah,
definitely. But that, building the program, getting the right numbers, and getting out and performing more to kind of build a recruiting base. We got out within the state, took the big band out, took the faculty group out once we kind of built that faculty group. And just complying with like a lot of the modern things that the colleges have adapted and trying to make it work within our jazz program.
Right. So, yeah. You know, one thing I will say that I'd noticed over the past 15, 20 years, working in New Orleans for so many years, is the number of students, playing students, that come from Florida State.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not just, you know, I'm not getting paid to plug Florida State. I'm just, it's just a fact. You know, like so many great players who are in New Orleans now or have passed through New Orleans, a lot of them still in New Orleans, went through that program. So you guys are doing it.
We're trying. You know, we still have the philosophy of like the roots of jazz,
right?
Blues and swing, and you know, they learn a lot of history about New Orleans, and I think that's the one of the reasons why a lot of them come to New Orleans. We also tell them too, like Tallahassee's great, but you got to get out of here, and you need to go and be a part of an actual music environment.
Right.
And just a few places around us. I mean, you could go south to Orlando. That's a different scene.
Do a lot of the students do that?
A few do.
Okay.
Then there's Atlanta right above us. But really, I always tell my students, if you really want to like get a lot of great experience playing jazz, you need to go to New Orleans.
Right.
And it took one or two to kind of come here first, and then it was like a flood of them.
Right.
So, you know, I brag on the city all the time because it was so important for me. It was so much a big part of my musical growth.
Right.
So I just encourage my students to check it out. I tell them to go visit the city, go hear people, and then they start moving here. So, but we just try to keep them engaged with like the real core essence of the music.
Right.
Teach them all the fundamentals of their instrument. You know, expose them to Ellington and Basie, and teach them about New Orleans music. You know, some schools don't really teach. Like some students don't really know what a second line is,
and
so they understand like polyphonic improvisation and you know how those brass bands work. I mean, I teach that. We teach that there.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's so important. And honestly, to prepare a student, when you play in New Orleans, you know, yes, the jazz tradition is so rich, but as you know, it's a blessing in that city because you can play so many different types of jobs.
That's right.
Yeah. R&B, gospel, funk,
yeah,
you name it. And when you see those students, again, coming from Florida State, like I'm thinking of Jameson Ross, the bass player you have tonight, Amina Scott, these players can play anything.
Yeah.
You know, so kudos to y'all.
We're just trying to keep it going. That's all. Yeah.
Well, so that's the teaching thing, which obviously you can continue to do. But what are you excited about these days as far as playing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was able to do my first record. I mean, I've always worked as a sideman and recorded on several records as a sideman. But when Jason presented that that opportunity to me, I already had a folder full of music written. And every now and then I would pull some stuff out. We play somewhere locally in town or whatever. And I've always wanted to record my music. Jason just kind of gave me the push to do it.
Right. And sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah, he offered me the venue. Like, okay. And then I just, something just clicked to say, well, just try to apply for a grant so you can fund it. I got the award for the grant. And so I booked Snug and, you know, figured everything out, how to pay for everything. And a former colleague of mine, Nick Finzer, who now teaches at University of North Texas, came out of Juilliard in New York. He came through Tallahassee and taught a couple of years of trombone with us. But he also started a record label that's based out of New York. I called Nick and I said, Nick, I'm gonna go in the studio and record some music. Would you be interested in like checking it out to see if maybe you might wanna put it on your label? And I explored a couple of other options too. And so so I did a recording at Snug and I got it mixed in New Orleans as well and got it mastered, sent it to Nick. And I was like, would this be something you would put out? And he said, absolutely. I was kind of taken aback by that. Because it's all original music. It's all original music, tunes that I wrote based on my life from about the mid-90s to, I think I wrote one of the tunes 2 weeks before we did the record. So, it's just a collection of life experiences is what it is.
Yeah.
And I thought it befitting to do it at the place where I felt like was my second home, which is Snug Harbor. So it all kind of came together in the right way.
Yeah.
And I'm already working on a project now where I want to do my first studio record.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working on some other music that I've had already and some other tunes that I'm writing. So I want to do my first studio project, hopefully within the next year or two maybe.
Okay.
But yeah, it's just a collection of music, original music. And, Ricardo is a former student of ours that's on the record. And of course, my colleague Rodney on bass. I met Oscar Rossignoli on a gig in South Carolina with Amina, actually. That's where I first heard him.
Okay.
We played a jazz club out there called the Jazz Corner in Hilton Head.
Mm-hmm.
And the trumpet player, at first I was going to have Etienne Charles, but Etienne had a conflict that he couldn't make it. And so Ricardo had been playing a lot with John Michael Bradford, and he's like, well, man, John Michael and I play together all the time. You know, you should consider having him on the record. So the first time I met John Michael was the first rehearsal we had for the record.
And the power of freelancing.
Yeah,
and
and
recommendations.
It just clicked. The band just clicked. So that's how the band came together.
Yeah, well, that's a killer band.
Yeah, I've had a great time. And I work with all of those guys as much as I can. So that original band performed at this past Jazz Fest, which was a lot of fun. That was the first time we had played together since the recording.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And before we started taping today, you had mentioned that you were just up in Chicago.
Yes.
So what'd you have going on up there?
So I was in Chicago with a guy by the name of Carlos Vega, great tenor player. He actually teaches in the jazz program at Florida A&M University.
Okay.
And but he's based out of Chicago. I'll take that back. He's from Miami, but I think he lived in the Chicago area for a while. So because the rest of the musicians that we played with up there were all Chicago cats.
Mm-hmm.
So we did. He just put out a record of music maybe 2 years ago or so.
Yeah.
So we performed his music, and it was kind of like a pre-Gin performance because that band will be performing at Gin on the last Saturday of the conference.
So to let people know, that's the Jazz Education Network
conference that will be in New Orleans, actually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm really excited about the show tonight. I know
I'm
it's going
to
be
very much looking forward to it.
And then you're coming back home to Snug Harbor tomorrow night.
Yes. This is like I consider it my second home.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my birthplace is Shreveport, but I definitely feel like New Orleans is like my second home.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Leon, I really appreciate you, doing this interview.
I thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor.
And then as part of this podcast, the listeners and viewers are going to be able to see our colleague, our old friend, Bill Grimes, do our little trio thing that we recorded. So thank you, Bill, for being part of that.
Yes, sir.
And, again, I'm really looking forward to tonight, man.
I'm looking forward to. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Very much so.
So thank you, Leon.
Pleasure, man. All right.
The Arts Council of the Greater Baton Rouge would like to acknowledge our generous sponsors, the Shell Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, and the City of Baton Rouge.